we're gonna take a trip right now. Like we always do about this time.
This is a journey into sound. Break it
down. I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. For the next 2 weeks on Cultural Manifesto, we'll listen back to some of my favorite interviews of 2022. We'll hear words and music from a wide variety of local and national artists, including Angelique Kidjo, Emily Wells, Colin Blunstone of The Zombies, and many more. We'll start with an excerpt from my interview with the experimental pop music trio Sun Lux. Sun Lux composed the score to one of this year's most talked about films, Everything Everywhere, All at Once. The film's soundtrack features an all-star list of guest collaborators, including Randy Newman, David Byrne, and Indianapolis's own Hannah Benn. Sun Lux told me that much of the soundtrack was recorded here in Indianapolis. Let's join my conversation with Sun Lux as we discuss the group's connection to the city.
Hi, this is Ian Chang.
Rafiq Bhatia.
Ryan Lott.
Ian, Rafiq, and Ryan, thank you so much for taking time to be here today. We're going to talk about your upcoming show here in Indianapolis and your score for a remarkable new film called Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. And this is an incredible film, and you've created an equally incredible soundtrack, so I'm excited to share this music with our listeners. And I understand that Indianapolis played a role in the creation of this soundtrack, and I know our listeners will be very interested to hear more about that. So can you tell us what role Indianapolis played in the creation of this amazing score you created?
Oh, thank you so much for the compliments and for the invitation. This is Ryan talking. We signed onto this project before the pandemic hit. It was fall 2019 when Daniels reached out to us. They were fans of our music, both as a band and also individually. And we started having a conversation about this insane project they were scheming. And they had a rough script in hand, and they shared it with us, and it was totally bananas and amazing.
And twice as long.
Yeah, and twice as long as it wound up being. And we were super excited, but we also kind of like, part of us wondered if it was really going to happen, just because it was such an improbable film to imagine being made. But as it started to blossom into reality, and even before then, honestly, we started to generate sounds and start sharing, crazy little sonic ideas with Daniels. At the time, I lived in Los Angeles, and then Rafiq and Ian were in town at the beginning of March of 2020, and we had an incredibly productive week of working on our records at the time and also the score. And we even had spent a whole day on set with the film, which was in the middle of, or toward the end, actually it was toward the end of its production at that time. They just had 2 days left of shooting. But it was right when things were getting super weird. And essentially what happened was, right after that week, my wife Jennifer, who grew up in Indianapolis, and my son had planned to make a trip to visit family in Indy. And I was like, yo, I don't feel like I want to wind up on the wrong side of the country as you guys right now, because things were starting to shut down and just get really strange. And, we said to ourselves, yo, this could last weeks, maybe months, you know? So I was like, let me just get a ticket on that plane. So I threw my trash can Mac and my central hard drives into a Pelican case and stuffed it with like a couple shirts and got on the plane to Indianapolis. And we didn't take the return flight. And then what proceeded to happen was we kept on working on the score remotely. and kept delaying our, you know, plans to return to Los Angeles. And the majority of the score was made in a rented first, actually a donated bedroom in a small empty house in Indianapolis on Westfield. And then right down the street, eventually in a little rented office in Broad Ripple.
That's amazing. And, you know, subsequent to the creation of the album, I know you've been rehearsing for your tour recently. And from what I understand, Rafiq and Ian, you've been here in Indianapolis as well, living and working for a bit. Is that correct? And anything you want to share about your experiences here?
Yeah, that's correct. For rehearsals for this tour, we decided to, rather than like go to like a rehearsal space or something like that, we decided to book an Airbnb in Broad Ripple. So close to Ryan. So he, you know, he can be close to family. And it was a space where we were able, Rafiq and I were able to kind of like both like sleep and live there. But then in the basement, we set up like a nice, like little rehearsal setup for us. And thankfully, like the neighbors never said anything because it was an old building with like foundations that were like, you couldn't really hear anything actually from the outside while we were playing, which is amazing. And yeah, it was fun because it really was very freeing to be able to just like walk downstairs at any moment and be at our instruments and our stations. And it all, there's an element of it that felt very kind of like I was like back in like high school or something, like you know, playing in like a friend's like basement, you know, playing music. And that was really nice too, because it just felt like a very comfortable situation. And yeah, we really enjoyed our time in Indy. And we, you know, a lot of Sunlux creations have happened on the soil of Indianapolis at this point.
That's great. And one final question.
You know, funny you said that. It's actually funny you say that. Our biggest like Sunlux song is called Easy. Mm-hmm. And I actually started writing that song in Indianapolis in my wife's childhood bedroom. And it's like,
I've been there. Yeah,
yeah, occasionally I have this memory that actually that song was like kind of like, you know, all it started there.
Easy. Easy. Pull out your heart to me.
From the soundtrack of Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, this is Sunlux with This Is a Life, featuring David Byrne and Mitski.
Free from entropy,
entangled for eternity. we've known.
That was Sun Lux with This Is a Life, featuring David Byrne and Mitski. This week on Cultural Manifesto, we're looking back at some of my favorite interviews from 2022. Up next, we'll listen to an excerpt of my interview with the Grammy-winning vocalist, Falu. She performed in Indianapolis in September. Falu's music combines North Indian classical music with influences of pop, rock, and folk music. She calls this style Indie Hindi. During my conversation with Falu, we discussed our shared love for the iconic Bollywood film composer R.D. Burman. Falu covered Burman's psychedelic classic Dum Maro Dum on her self-titled 2007 album. We'll hear that track in a moment. But first, let's hear an excerpt from my conversation with Falu. And Falu, you coined a phrase to describe the music you were making in the United States during the early 2000s. You coined the phrase Indie Hindi, right?
Yes.
tell me what that means to you.
So, obviously, everything that I've learned, folk, Indian classical, semi-classical, they are, that's all old, right? It's mm-hmm. passed on, it's at least 3,000 years old. And when you bring those essences, the fluidity of that culture into America, and the instrumentation is not necessarily Indian, it is a bass, it is a keyboard, it's a piano, it's a guitar, the harmonies that are created in those instruments, when you are singing your phrases, first of all, that's a very unique sound, right? And you're capturing that nuance with composition based in a very old raga and English lyrics on top of it. So here we are taking the roots of Indian raga with English lyrics, but not so much that it hurts these traditions, but actually mixes it very gently without affecting the uniqueness of both, and then coloring it with American instrumentation, sometimes Indian tabla as well, and you know, sometimes Indian sarangi. But the culmination and the product of proportionality of bringing these three things together, or four, and that became, I think, a very popular sound in this area where I was trying to flourish, Indie Hindi. So that's Indie Hindi, which is age-old ancient culture coming into the modern phase, but keep drawing from both, but keeping the originality.
Falu, you released, I think, your debut solo album in 2007. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And I love this album. And there's a track on that album in particular that I wanted to ask you about. You do an extraordinary version of one of my all-time favorite pieces of music written by one of my all-time musical heroes, Dumb Morrow Dumb by R.D. Burman. You do a fantastic version of this song. And, you know, we're talking about incorporating all these stylistic influences into one's music. He was truly a master of that. Tell me about your version of this song and if R.D. Burman's music has been an influence on you.
So, you know, I have never said this in any interview, but I will tell you. My R.D. Burman was a very every weekend visitor. Wow. In my grandma's and my uncle's house.
Wow.
So when he, every weekend, every Saturday night or Friday night, he, Kishore Kumar, my uncle Praveen, and me, as a little child, I was 3, 4, 5 years old, just wandering there. It's, you know how we have parties and people come over and we're having drinks and dinner?
Sure.
Every weekend, R.D. Burman came to my grandfather's house, where I was there too. And they just created music. Anand Bakshi, the writer, the lyricist.
Yes.
So he, the way I remember these scenes precisely in my mind, where they would have a subject, a theme to work on. And I don't know if Dumb Morrow Dumb was written like that, but I know a couple of songs that they wrote in front of me. Mm. I was 3 years old, right? And they would say, the theme is this. And Anand Bakshi had a, he would let me show you the video. He would do this. Anand Bakshi would do this. Like that, with a handkerchief.
Okay.
And in 2 minutes, he would write out lyrics. And R.D. Burman would then sometimes understand the language. And sometimes he would say, what does Nashaman mean? Is that a village or is that a city? What is this? And he might ask him a couple of lyrical questions. And then they would clarify. And R.D. Burman would, right there in that harmonium, in that room with my uncle and Kishore Kumar, compose, and that song became the Maradam.
Wow.
Or whichever.
Yes.
So I grew up with these people. I can't tell you how blessed I am. I grew up with them having fun every weekend in my house.
I'm speechless. That's unbelievable.
And I've never shared this story. I don't know why, because nobody asked me.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes like experiences like this happen, but you don't really share it because no one really asked me.
Mm.
But my entire upbringing was with the blessings of R.D. Burman, Anand Bakshi, Shakti Samant, the filmmaker, Amar Prem, or more, and of course, Ustad Sultan Khan. So how blessed can any child be who is around the best of the best?
Wow. You know what? I think what spoke to me about his music was his ability to interpret, you know, Western music styles, whether it was psychedelic rock like in Dumb Morrow Dumb, or, you know, funk music, disco music, Latin music, whatever the case may be. How do you kind of, tell me about his music and like what it means to you in India. Yeah.
He was a genius. Yeah. So there is a movie called Satte Pe Satta. Mm-hmm. And in that, there's a song where...
Is it Seven Brides for Seven Brothers?
Like something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of vocal effect. So he made singers gargle on the mic.
Yeah.
Like all the singers were, they were gargling with water. And he recorded that sound. I mean, this man was a walking genius. The way he would listen to the any object that's not even musical, he would incorporate a beer bottle in a song. He would incorporate gargling into music. What kind of brilliance is that?
Yeah, incredible. It's incredible.
And I saw that recording, Satte Pe Satta, the seven boys, the seven brothers. I was in that studio, in that recording, when that gargling was happening.
It's a remake of a famous American musical, right? Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. Do you know about that? An old Hollywood movie. Yeah, I was just going to throw that out there for our listeners that may have that as a frame of reference.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Thank
I believe
you for sharing
so.
That.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that story about R.D. Burman. Like I said, I was obsessed with him for a long time and tried to track down all his albums and cassettes. And yeah,
I am too. And yeah. I will show you some old photographs when I see you.
Oh, please.
Of
yes.
him having a cigarette and smoking and, you know, doing all this and having drinks in my house with my uncle. I'll show you all the pictures.
Please. Yeah.
अब जो मिली है तो बाहों को बाहों में रहने दे साजना सच्चे की झूठी है होंठों को होंठों से कहने दे साजना ना ना अब जो मिली है तो बाहों को बाहों में रहने दे साजना सच्चे की झूठी है होंठों को होंठों से कहने दे साजना ना ना अब जो मिले हैं तो हाय रे हाय रे हाय रे साजना
This is Falu with Dumb Morrow Dumb.
Bolo subha sham
That was Falu with Dum Maro Dum. Cultural Manifesto will return after this short break. I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. On this week's show, we're listening back to some of my favorite interviews of 2022. Up next, we'll listen to an excerpt of my conversation with the Indianapolis rock band Karate, Guns, and Tanning. Their 2021 album, Concrete Beach, has earned an international cult following among fans of psychedelic shoegaze music. Let's hear an excerpt of my conversation with Valerie Green and Joy Caroline Mills of Karate, Guns, and Tanning.
I'm Valerie Green, and I play bass and sing, and I play some synths and random kind of keyboard stuff.
My name is Joy Caroline Mills, and I play lead guitar, and I also do some synth stuff and some backup vocals for Valerie as well.
And as we get started, I want to ask about the band's name, which is a very distinct name. And I think maybe this is a question for you, Valerie. This name relates to the town in Indiana where you spent your formative years, right? Tell us about the name of this band.
Yeah, so the name comes from a former strip mall in Plainfield, Indiana, on the west side of Indianapolis where I grew up. And if you can guess what was in the strip mall, there was a karate studio, a tanning salon, and a gun store. So Karate, Guns, Tanning, it was just a giant sign that advertised those three Midwest necessities, I guess. So our former engineer, he kind of had always thought it would make a cool band name. And so when we were putting the band together, we thought that would be appropriate as kind of a homage to where we grew up in suburban Midwest. And also we thought it would be great for SEO. No one's going to have that name.
You know, I grew up around the same area you did in Hendricks County, just outside of Indianapolis, and it was kind of a cultural void when I was there as a kid. How did that impact your artistic imagination?
Well, I think like maybe a lot of people have that story that grow up in those kind of areas, which most of the country is, like there's not much else to do, you know? So playing music, I was in every single band I could possibly be in. Started on French horn and then moved to electric bass and studied upright bass all through high school. So I played in symphonic band, jazz band, all of that. So by the end of my high school career, most of my classes were music. And it just was something that you had to kind of make your own fun and not a lot of distractions in Plainfield, Indiana. So, yeah, I think it probably helped. You had to make your own entertainment.
And Joy, tell us about where you grew up and kind of your introduction to performing music.
Yeah, so similar kind of to Valerie, grew up in the Midwestern suburbs. We moved here from Hawaii. I'm a Navy kid. So I grew up McCordsville area, Fishers area. And so my music journey, I really started young. We moved here from Hawaii and I just really got into country music. I don't know. I was fascinated by guitar and I was just like, that's so cool that there's an instrument that can say so much. And it's so versatile. So I just jumped in and started playing it. And then, this one found me a few years ago and, I really like sonically what she's doing and her vision. So that's been really fun to play with her.
And Joy and Valerie, Karate, Guns, and Tanning have a somewhat new album out titled Concrete Beach. It came out last year in March, I believe. This is an extraordinary record. It's really sonically powerful. You know, when you listen to it, there's so many musical textures kind of swirling around. And I wanted to ask you about kind of the musical influences you were bringing into this project. You know, when I listened to this, I heard industrial music, 60s psychedelic rock, shoegaze music from the 90s, and there's even, you know, more conventional pop songs and pop structures to the music. Tell us a little bit about the influences you were bringing into this project and kind of what you wanted to say with this record.
Yeah, it's. I'll tell you about the new record later on, too, that kind of ties into all of that. But yeah, I think that somehow all of us in this band have very different influences. And I think that's kind of the magic of it for me is that all of these different influences kind of mix together and mash together. And somehow they have formed like this sound, you know, this sound that is Karate, Guns, and Tanning. But For me, I grew up, I kind of went through every phase you could go through. Like, obviously, I was studying classical music, but I was very interested in like the grunge scene, like Nirvana, when that came around, I was pretty young. But from that, I went to like harder metal and got into Metallica. And I played with some guys in high school, and we would just like drill on these Metallica riffs. So that was kind of my love of metal and heavy music came from that. And then I got into techno and the rave scene that was like exploding around Indianapolis when I was like a little out of high school. And then I got into jam band and like a lot of like funk, and got into the organ, Hammond B3. So like my musical history is just all over the place. And I loved playing with Daniel. He's got elements of stuff that I love, like very much funk, and also has like some jazz kind of tendencies, but also very powerful drummer as well. And then Joy brings this kind of pop sensibility to the project. But she also is like dived into shoegaze and all of these other, she's kind of like, she's a little younger than me. So she's also discovered some of the stuff that I feel like I get to like kind of, hey, check this out for my like crazy history. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think everyone brings like such a their own flavor, and it somehow works.
Yeah, Joy, the guitar sounds on the record are really imaginative and powerful. Sometimes even within the same song, you're doing so many different things. It's just you add so much to this album. Tell us a little about your approach to the guitar and performing for this band.
That's so nice. Thank you, first of all. second of all, I bring a pop sensibility because I'm a firm believer that pop music, popular music, doesn't always have the same connotation as bad music. It's popular for a reason. So on any track that I'm playing on for guitar, I kind of view it as, am I going to add another emotional layer to this, or am I going to take away from the sonic composition that's already there? So when I'm writing for KGT, I really, a lot of the pop influence comes in because I'm like, you know, what can I add here that will be a little bit more interesting? And then just the tones that I pick, I'm kind of like an audiophile. So it's been kind of 10 to 15 years of picking out the right tones and pedals. And I'm really proud of that. So just kind of, thank you for noticing that too. So just kind of picking out sounds, I can just kind of hear in my head what I want it to sound like with this music. So like she said, kind of our flavors just kind of work together, and I can bring in the pop sensibilities.
This is Karate, Guns, and Tanning with Fire.
Thank you.
That was Karate Guns and Tanning with Fire. On this week's show, we're listening back to some of my favorite interviews of 2022. Up next, we'll hear an excerpt of my conversation with Colin Blundstone of the legendary British rock band The Zombies. Blundstone and The Zombies toured across the Midwest United States during the summer of 2022. And I asked Blundstone about The Zombies' early tours in the United States. And we're speaking as The Zombies are in preparation to begin a North American tour this year. And I was curious if touring in America is still meaningful for you. I know you first came here in 1964. You'd grown up playing American music, listening to Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Elvis, and I'm sure that first tour here was very meaningful for you. Is it still meaningful for you to tour and perform in the U.S.?
Well, absolutely. I think on two levels, really. One, you've just mentioned that so much of contemporary music has started in America, beginning with the blues, rhythm and blues, rock and roll, jazz. It's all American music, and that's why all musicians from the UK want to play in America, because so much of what we listen to originated in America. On another level, I think that in some ways, I think that music means more to American audiences than it does to a lot of to audiences in a lot of other countries. Yeah. Americans really appreciate music, and they're very knowledgeable and just great audiences, to appreciative audiences to play to. So I look forward to going to America on lots of levels, but certainly there are two of them. And as you rightly said, we first came to America on Christmas 1964. So we now have many friends in America. We've been coming for 70 something years, and I feel really at home in America. I think the two countries are much more similar now than they were in 1964. I think that our lifestyles were quite different in 64 in many ways, but now I really don't notice the difference so much coming from the UK to America, just that you have more appreciative audiences.
The way you tour now is much different than the way the Zombies were touring in the mid-1960s. You know, now you're a headline act, you're the main feature. In the early days of the groups touring in the United States, you were playing on these package shows, these reviews, which would often have maybe 10 to 12 other acts playing on the same bill. What was it like being part of these package tours? And, you know, from what I understand, you were in a van with the other artists, you know, touring across the country. You played with the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars, and you were all in a van traveling together. What was that experience like?
Well, in some ways, it was really good. There was a great camaraderie backstage, and when we were traveling, I think, if anything, there were more acts than you just mentioned. Mm. You know, there were 15 or 16 acts, but it was quite tough because we were on a bus, but there were no facilities on the bus at all. And to be absolutely honest, because some of the poor guys lower down on the bill weren't being paid very much, we couldn't stay in hotels every night. We only stayed every second night. So it meant that on alternate nights, we would drive through the night just sitting on this pretty uncomfortable bus, we might say a coach in this country. So it did get pretty exhausting towards the end. I think in the six weeks I think we were on tour, I think I lost about a stone while we were, that's 14 pounds while we were on tour. So the traveling was pretty tough, especially because we didn't stay in hotels every night, but otherwise it was pretty good fun. I mean, we got to know these other acts really well.
It does sound grueling to live out of a van, especially when you were traveling with 20 or 30 other people, you know, crowded into the same van. But some of those people that you were touring with in the 1960s were the greatest legends in American rhythm and blues music. And as someone who'd grown up listening to that music, that must have been incredibly meaningful for you to have that time living and working with these artists and to, you know, share this experience with them. What did that mean to you personally? You were a teenager at the time, really. Yeah, what did that mean to you?
I was a teenager, yeah. Well, it was absolutely fantastic. I mean, when we first came over, we played Murray the K's Christmas show at the Brooklyn Fox. And the people on there, Dionne Warwick, the Shirelles, the Shangri-Las, again, there were 14 or 15 acts, and it was incredible. And then when we did the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars, one of the things I remember is that as we got on the bus and the first night, we drove through the night, and after about half an hour, all this gospel music started up in the back of the bus, which is where I was right in the middle of it, and it was absolutely beautiful. And after a couple of nights, the guys on the bus turned to particularly Rod and I from the Zombies and said, okay, you know, you've listened to us sing, now it's your turn. And boy, that was a bit of a worrying moment. And we had to stand up and sing for them. I think we sang If I Fell, because Rod and I did a pretty good version of that. You know, the two-part harmony of If I Fell. And I have to say, it went down very well. And we were accepted after that. That was our test, you know, to be accepted. Pretty scary, but we got through it.
Yeah. It seems like you had some exciting adventures on the road in America. I read a story that you sort of barnstormed Graceland looking for Elvis while you were in Memphis. Is that true, that the band showed up at the home of Elvis?
It's absolutely true. We were doing an interview with a local DJ in Memphis. And at the end of the interview, he said to us, as if it was like, you know, a mutual friend that lived around the corner, he said, you know, do you fancy going around to see Elvis? And we looked at one another in astonishment, said, well, yeah, haven't got much on at the moment. Yeah, okay, well, let's go. So we went around there. There was no security at all. I don't know if we were just lucky, but there wasn't. We just walked up the drive and knocked on the front door. And we never quite worked out if it was his father or his uncle came to the door. And he was absolutely charming. But Elvis was away, he was filming in Hawaii. Mm. And he said to us, you know, Elvis would be really disappointed he missed you. And we thought he was just being really nice. But later on, we were told by someone who appeared to know everything about Elvis that Elvis actually had our records on his jukebox. Mm. So he did know who we were, and you know, it would have been very interesting if we had met him. As it was, his father or his uncle said to us, well, listen, just have a look around, make yourselves at home. And that's what we did. We didn't actually meet Elvis, I'm afraid to say, but it was a real experience, and we've been back there since. Mm. And told that story to all the people. It's very, very different now, but there's actually a radio station on the grounds, and we told that story of the first time we came to Graceland from their own radio station, and I think they were pretty amused by it as well.
We just heard an excerpt of my 2022 conversation with Colin Blunstone of The Zombies. Let's listen to a track from The Zombies' classic 1968 album, Odyssey and Oracle. We'll hear This Will Be Our Year.
The warmth of your love's like the warmth from the sun, and this will be our year to the long time to come. Don't let go of my hand now, darkness has gone. This will be our year, took a long time to come. And I won't forget the way you helped me up when I was down. And I won't forget the way you said, darling, I love you, you gave me faith to go on. Now we're there and we've only just begun. This will be our year, took a long time to come. Smile, smile for me, little one. And this will be our year, took a long time to come.
don't have to worry, all your worry days are gone. And this will be our year, took a long time to come. And I won't forget the way you helped me up when I was down. And I won't forget the way you said, darling, I love you. You gave me faith to go on. Now we're there, and we've only just begun. This will be our year, took a long time to come. And this will be our year, took a long time to come.
That was The Zombies with This Will Be Our Year. On this week's show, we're listening back to some of my favorite interviews of 2022. Up next, we'll hear an excerpt from my interview with Daryl Black Eagle Jameson of Medicine Singers, a unique collaboration between the Rhode Island-based Native American powwow group Eastern Medicine Singers and the psychedelic Israeli punk rock guitarist Yonatan Gat. Medicine Singers issued their debut album in 2022 on the Indianapolis-based label Joyful Noise Recordings. I asked Jameson if he was concerned that the group's radical blend of traditional and electronic sounds would draw criticism from music purists.
Yeah, hey, there'll be some out there that want to take shots and everything, but am I going to listen to them? No.
How do you feel about putting this record out? I mean, it seems like you're very proud of the work you've done. Are you excited for the release of this album and for people to experience this unique sound you all have created?
Yeah, I am. I'm proud of it. I sat back and listened to it again on SoundCloud last night, and I'm like, you know, this is really a cool album. Yeah. And the thing is that we have a Western styled guy in there from the Plains that did music, and his contribution was just as great as us, you know, as far as the song that he did and everything. And you know, I don't think that people are going to be criticizing it as much as one would think, because you got different nations in there doing stuff. You know, we have a brother on my drum that he lived on Pine Ridge. He speaks both Wampanoag and he speaks, you know, Lakota. And he's also in there, you know. So this album's really a flash of different culture, you know.
Yeah, Yonatan told me there's a South American indigenous vocalist as well from northern Brazil. Yeah,
and he does an excellent job, you know. So, and that's why we said it's medicine, you know, it's a medicine singers.
Yeah.
You know, because it really is. It's like all these, where else can you get up to different natives coming together and singing on an album, you know? I mean, it's just unheard of, you know. It's either one style or the other. But now you got, you know, east, south, you know, southeast, the deep southeast. And you got, you know, West, and we're all singing together and stuff and doing something together. So, I mean, it's really, you know, I don't think it's going to take as much criticism as people think it is. There's a lot of native rappers out there people don't like. There's a lot of, you know, I mean, I know some guys out there that are friends of mine that do native rap in Canada and here, right here in Rhode Island, and people give them, you know, some people criticize them, but they're still famous. You know, they're still doing good. They're selling records.
That desire to criticize, like, Native American rappers and projects like this, what do you think that says about how people in North America perceive Native American indigenous people? It's like every other culture can change their culture with the times and incorporate different influences, but people, for some reason, have trouble seeing Native American culture adapt to changes in style and music. And what do you think that says about the perception of Native Americans
in North America.
Yeah, I think that's why we need to do this project.
Yeah.
That's because people need to see that everything's not black and white, you know. Every Indian doesn't look the same. I'm not going to look the same as a Lakota.
Yeah.
And an Indian from Manitoba is not going to look the same as me, as well as Inuit. It's not going to look the same. And they all have different styles of singing. Look, they have throat singing. Mm. I don't know anything about throat singing, but that's their tradition and their style. Who am I to criticize it? You know? And who is somebody who doesn't even know my language to criticize what I'm doing, you know? And that's kind of the way I look at it. I mean, and you know, that's why people like us need to come out and show the world that, you know, first of all, my whole thing was to show people that our Indian culture is just as good as equal to the regular mainstream, you know, white culture that's out there. The two can exist together. They can work together, you know. And they can blend together. It's experimental art. That's what it is.
Yeah, you
know?
Yeah.
And we're going to, you know, that's what we want to do. We're going to show the world experimental art from the Eastern Algonquin side of the world and hope they like it.
We just heard an excerpt from my conversation with Daryl Black Eagle Jameson of Medicine Singers. And we'll end this week's show with a track from their debut album, a stunning version of Link Wray's classic guitar instrumental, Rumble. Thanks for tuning in for this look back at some of my favorite interviews from 2022. Check out the Cultural Manifesto podcast on Spotify and Apple Music to hear the full episodes. I'm Kyle Long, and you've been listening to Cultural Manifesto.